I'm Joel Parker, and this is Hell on Earth, the KGNU Science Show. Today is Tuesday, March 19th, 2024. Coming up, we hear about recent research presented at the American Astronomical Society meeting. In this, part 3 of the series, we hear about the Habitable Worlds Observatory and about imposter phenomenon. First, we hear from Shelley Schlender about a new environmental approach to a modern-day parenting problem.
500 years. That's how long it takes a disposable diaper in a landfill to decompose. Using cloth diapers eliminates the problem, but disposable diapers are so much more convenient. They're the third most common consumer product in landfills. That's why there's growing excitement about biodegradable diapers.
What we want is to give customers a sustainable choice when it comes to purchasing diapers, pads, and incontinence products.
Antonio Capeza is with the Royal Institute of Technology in Stockholm, Sweden. He says that not only do disposable diapers last hundreds of years, they're made of ecologically harmful petrochemicals.
These materials, then we're creating an impact. And then when we dispose these materials, these products, they are non-biodegradable. So if it goes into the environment, what is going to happen is that they will produce microplastics. So that is the impact that we do today. One, when we buy them, and the other one is when we dispose them after used.
Capeza's team is replacing the petrochemicals in diapers and other sanitary products with plant-based materials. One wicks up liquid, like any good diaper must do. A different plant-based material creates a diaper's much-needed water-blocking barrier. But instead of taking 500 years to decompose, these biodegradable diapers can turn back into, basically, healthy soil in less than 2 months.
These natural materials, mainly, for example, proteins, when they go into the environment and when they start degrading, well, they will degrade into molecules that nature can take in again as a new food, for example, meaning that there's not going to be a microplastic to be worried about. It's mainly molecules that nature can use to grow the next generation of plants, for example.
Consumers might even be able to flush these biodegradable diapers down a toilet someday, according to the American Chemical Society, which has recently published these findings. For How on Earth, I'm Shelley Schlender.
Over the course of 5 days in early January, more than 2,500 astronomers attended the American Astronomical Society's 243rd meeting. These meetings are held in various locations around the country. The first was in Williams Bay, Wisconsin in September 1899. This recent meeting was held in New Orleans, Louisiana. At these meetings, scientists, students, administrators, and others gather to hear talks about new research from planets to black holes to galaxies and interstellar gas. There are workshops to discuss new ideas, possible missions, learning programming, and career sessions and networking. Representatives from NASA, the National Science Foundation, and other agencies attend to give updates and get feedback from the researchers. There is vibrant hallway conversation and even an open mic night where astronomers show off their non-science skills. I talked with a small but diverse selection of the scientists who attended this meeting, often referred to as the AAS meeting, and in this edition of How on Earth, we will hear some of the work going on in astronomy-related research.
In part two of this series, 2 weeks ago, we talked with Dr. Megan Ansdell, program scientist at NASA headquarters in the Astrophysics Division and the Planetary Science Division. She discussed applications of artificial intelligence in astrophysics research. She returns with us today to talk about the Habitable Worlds Observatory that had a special workshop at the AAAS meeting.
The Habitable Worlds Observatory is NASA's next flagship mission after the Roman Space Telescope. It was the top priority recommendation flagship mission concept out of the Astro 2020 Decadal Survey. And it is a mission that is going to be transformative for all of astrophysics. It'll be a large aperture telescope. It'll operate in the ultraviolet, optical, and infrared, so very similar to Hubble, but the capabilities will be, you know, orders of magnitude greater.
You say same capabilities as Hubble, but a big mirror. How big compared to Hubble?
The mirror will be something around 6 meters. I think it has to be at least around 6 meters to do the sort of science that it's made for. So the Habitable Worlds Observatory, I just mentioned that it'll be transformative for almost all of astrophysics because of its wide wavelength range, its large aperture telescope, things like that. But the reason why it has those features on it is because it's the first spacecraft to be designed specifically to detect an Earth-like planet around a sun-like star and to measure what we call biosignatures in the atmospheres of those. And in order to do that and do it in a reliable way where you can actually make some sort of statement on the potential habitability of that planet, you have to have this big aperture and this broad wavelength range. And those capabilities will in turn be able to do a whole bunch of astrophysics, not just look for habitable planets.
So at the American Astronomical Society meeting, you had a special workshop about the Habitable Worlds Observatory. So what was that like and who attended it and what ideas came out of it?
It was such a great splinter session. The room was standing room only for most of it and people stayed until the very end. So it was very well attended. It was really impressive to see the range of career stages there. You know, a lot of early career scientists, which is always great to see, and a lot of very senior people who, you know, had been rooting for this mission or something like it for so long. And it was just really nice to see. I think everybody was really excited about what was going on. And it was sort of a turning point for HWO, for the mission. So we've been doing a lot of planning. So the Decadal Survey came out, you know, in I think 2023-ish time. And since then, there's just been a lot of taking those recommendations and forming what we have today. So a lot of planning at the sort of NASA headquarters level. We selected these two community groups, one called the START, which is more science focused, one called the TAG, which is more engineering focused and technology focused. Those were selected at the end of last year. And we've been designing the sort of open working group structure. So we have these two selected teams that come from the community, but we really want everybody to be involved in these activities that we're going to undertake over the next year. And so this splinter session was really rolling all of that out and inviting the community to sign up for these working groups. So it's sort of a transition from like lots of planning to like finally doing things. So I think everybody was really excited to actually start like doing the work.
It almost sounds like you're crowdsourcing a new observatory.
I'm going to steal that tagline. that's kind of exactly what we're doing, you know, and doing it earlier than is normally done for a NASA mission. And the hope is to mature these parts of a mission coherently. So the science side, the technology side, the mission architecture side, get all of these people and as much input as we can to explore what is possible very early on, right? So that when we do eventually make the decision of how to design this observatory, we're making decisions that have been, you know, well vetted and well researched. And so, yeah, and we're crowdsourcing that part of it. And I think it's great. Everybody seems so excited and everybody feels like they can have a part in it, which is really great, especially when this mission isn't going to launch until the early 2040s, you know, ish timeframe. So it's good to get people excited and as many people as possible, because it's going to be a long time even from now.
So you're really in the conceptualization phase of this. And you mentioned launch not till 2040. It's interesting, I think, for a lot of people who don't work in this environment to really understand the time scale for one of these missions and great observatories. Do you have any kind of a timeline that you can kind of give an idea of, like, how you go from, ooh, this is a cool idea, to actually collecting photons in space?
Yeah, I mean, so the Habitable Worlds Observatory just came out as, you know, a recommendation from the Decadal Survey in 2023-ish timeframe. And I just said, you know, at least according to the Decadal Survey, if a bunch of, you know, things go in a certain way, it could be launched in the early 2040s, right? So that's 20 years, right, from now, or at least from when the Decadal made its statement. Mm-hmm. And people had already been thinking about something like this for at least a decade, right? So you have to go from this idea in your head to getting other people excited about it, making a team. You develop various phases of mission concept documents that get more and more detailed, right? The United States at least has this process called the Decadal Survey, which I mentioned a couple times, but that's where a lot of the recommended activities and goals for astrophysics and for the other NASA divisions as well, and the NSF and things like that. But the goal is to get in as a recommendation in the Decadal Survey. And once you do that, even then you have to get funding from Congress, right? You have to get support from OMB, the Office of Management and Budget, and the government. And then you can actually be called a mission and actually start going from things written on paper to more official things written on paper to eventually hardware building. And then to eventually, you know, instead of building separate things, you're building a spacecraft, and then you have to test it and everything. And then it launches. So astrophysics is lucky in that a lot of the missions just get launched into, you know, a Lagrange point or Earth orbit or something like that, and they operate. In planetary science, you launch something into, you know, towards your target, and sometimes after 30 or 40 years of thinking about this thing, you have to wait another 10 years before the mission actually gets there.
So, been there, done that.
Yeah.
It's a long road to get it into space, but at least in astrophysics, once you get it into space, it's almost instant gratification.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I wish you luck in that. And maybe I'll put on my calendar for 20 years from now to get back, get back to you, see how it's going.
Yep.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Of course. Yeah, I appreciate it.
That was Dr. Megan Anstell, Program Scientist at NASA Headquarters in the Astrophysics Division and the Planetary Science Division, talking about the Habitable Worlds Observatory. Jupiter and Saturn, both are on their own. If you just joined us, you are listening to How on Earth, the KGNU Science Show. I'm Joel Parker, and today's show features the third and final part of our series highlighting some topics presented at the recent American Astronomical Society meeting. Our next guest is Jennifer Bates, a licensed clinical social worker, the Broadening Participation Program Manager at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory, and is the project lead for the Radio Astronomy Data Imaging and Analysis Lab. You might wonder what a clinical social worker would talk about at an astronomy meeting, but believe it or not, astronomers are social humans and subject to the same social and cultural factors and personal concerns as anybody else. So, along those lines, Jennifer Bates' topic of her presentation at the AAS meeting was imposter phenomenon?
Imposter phenomenon is synonymous with imposter syndrome. There are some camps that are very strongly one or the other. It's a pendulum, and we don't really have a real strong say in which one it is. If you use the term syndrome, the fear is that it connotes a mental health disorder, which it is not, and it creates something that it's not. It makes it, it stigmatizes it in a way that it's not. Originally, imposter phenomenon was researched in the 70s by two psychologists that were looking at white women in the South who were very successful in their fields, but were doing things that would sabotage their careers. They doubted themselves, and they labeled it imposter phenomenon. And it's a cluster of characteristics wherein you doubt your success, even though you're very successful. You feel that you don't belong there. You're really afraid of being revealed as a fraud, and you're pretty sure that people can see right through you. It can create stress and anxiety. It can create sleepless nights. It can lead to a whole cluster of other mental health disorders, although it's not one itself. And most successful people experience it at some point in their lives. Up to 79% of successful people experience it at one time or another.
That's interesting, because the first time I ran across it as imposter syndrome at the time, I was a graduate student or a postdoc, and it seemed like that was a time in a career, because it seemed common along a lot of my peers, where you're suddenly being seen as moving into the professional world and feeling like you're not ready and you're just going to fake it through your thesis defense, and they're just laughing behind their hands, you know?
Yeah.
And so originally I came across it as early career scientists having it. Does it vary with age, or does it stick around forever?
It varies with situation. Right. So it varies with where you are in your life stage, and it varies with what you feel like is naturally a part of your personal expertise versus what you feel may not be exactly perfect or may not be a great fit. So, for instance, a lot of underrepresented minoritized professionals feel like, due to a lot of systemic and institutional situations, they have to leave their place of employment, leave where they're doing their research, and start again. And every time you start again, for example, you experience being an imposter. You wonder whether or not it's a good fit for you. Same with being a new parent or trying something new and different. If it comes naturally, then it might feel like, oh, what am I doing wrong that everyone else is struggling and this comes naturally? Or if it doesn't come naturally, it's like, oh, I am an imposter. This isn't a good fit for me. I'm not the right one, even though everyone said that I am. So it does strike early career professionals, but it can really be a very durable characteristic. And a lot of times people experience what feels like imposter syndrome episodically, like, oh, I feel like I'm not an expert. Now I am, and I feel comfortable and confident. And others experience it throughout their lifetimes. I work with a very successful professional in my private practice, and she consistently feels like an imposter. Even though she's published, she's very successful, people recognize her name, and she still wonders if she's an imposter every single day.
I assume that some of it is what you see and what you hear and people talking about it. You have a lot of people who seem extremely self-confident, perhaps over self-confident, at scientific meetings and things like that. And it seems like a lot of people don't talk about it, except maybe a very close group around you who may confide. So is that part of the motivation of, for instance, having these type of presentations at large scientific meetings like the American Astronomical Society?
Yeah, the goal is to really uncover this in this experience that many of us have alone, because one of the other qualities or characteristics of imposter phenomenon is that you feel isolated. I am the only one that has this experience. And institutionally, sometimes that is reinforced, right? Like, you don't really want to talk about your failures. When you don't get published, the responses that you get are really highlighting some of the negative things, what you didn't do right, what you need to improve upon. on. It's very rare that you are reinforced for things that you're really good at or that come naturally to you. And so being able to shine the light on this is a real experience. It's really expedited by the institution, and it's a real experience that many of us have. And being able to talk about it, then you realize you're not the only one. And so you get to do a reality check and say, oh, well, wait, if you're successful and you don't feel like you're good enough, and you're successful and you don't feel like you're good enough, then maybe it's not just me. And then you're able to really diffuse and really challenge some of those negative thoughts and preconceptions you have about yourself and your work.
Interesting. I suppose this is made even more difficult for traditionally underrepresented groups, like in astronomy, women and BIPOC people, who sometimes really are the only person in their institute representing, you know, who looks like them. And so you have that as just an additional layer of feeling like you might be an imposter. Is that in fact the case? And how do you address that?
Yeah, it is the case. You know, if you go to any of the other talks that are being had about being an underrepresented minoritized population in astronomy, in STEM, there's often a reference to, you know, my parents just happened to move to this neighborhood. I just happened to have this teacher that noticed these things in me. I just happened to be, and there's a lot of dumb luck that a lot of your M scientists attribute to their success. And that's a characteristic of imposter phenomenon. It's dumb luck. It's not that I'm smart enough. It's not that I'm really gifted at this. It's not that this is my calling. It's not that I'm an expert. It's dumb luck. Like, this path just happened to lead me into it. And as a URM, if you don't see anyone else that looks like you, or if those who look like you are extremely established and tenured and look like they've got it all going on, then you have no idea, and you will attribute it to dumb luck. And then when you aren't as successful, because we all have failures and mistakes and have to learn, then it feels like, oh, maybe I'm not supposed to be here. And then it's reinforced because you don't see anyone else that looks like you. So then you really start to think you're not supposed to be there. And then if you compound that with the presence of microaggressions, which have become more pronounced over time, especially post-COVID, mental health challenges for scientists really went up, and the number of microaggressions experienced, especially by women scientists, has really gone up post-COVID, then that's reinforced. You feel like, I don't belong here. And then you're told subtly, or, you know, quite overtly,
explicitly,
you don't belong here. Yeah, right. Sometimes it's pretty darn explicit. You know, I definitely have had students who say, I had a professor that said, I don't belong here. Or I had a professor that said, maybe I should try another major. And when you hear that, and you already wonder that, it's a pretty strong reinforcement that I'm an imposter.
So what was the response of this session at the American Astronomical Society meeting, and what do you see as the path forward?
Yeah, so we definitely received a lot of high praise, a lot of validation of, yeah, I experience it too. And, you know, the biggest question was, well, what do I do? What do I do about it now, right? And so part of uncovering the reality of imposter phenomenon is the ability to say, I am not alone in this, and then identify peers who feel that same way. Finding a mentor who can say, yes, I went through that too. Early career, it sucks in this way. It's going to get better. And you have those places of hope. And creating a lot of authentic connections from mentors to mentees, where they share really what happened instead of sugarcoating it, instead of assuming that it has to be one way. And mentors have a really strong role in this, because mentors, you don't have to do it the same way that it was for you. It doesn't have to be a bruising, hurtful process to go through a PhD program. It could be really rewarding and supportive. It doesn't have to be painful to be successful. And mentors can start to change that for their mentees and grow a new path forward.
Yeah, from my experience, I cannot overstress the importance of a good mentor in many aspects. And you can have mentors throughout your life. It's not just for the early career scientists. It can be invaluable as you go along, because different things come up
during different parts of your path through your career and through your life. That's really great about just getting the word out that getting a mentor is a very positive thing. Thank you very much for being on the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
That was Jennifer Bates, a licensed clinical social worker, the Broadening Participation Program Manager at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory, and the project lead for the Radio Astronomy Data Imaging and Analysis Lab, talking about imposter phenomenon. And that completes this series of shows highlighting recent research presented at the American Astronomical Society meeting held in January. You can find the first two episodes of this series on the KGNU and How on Earth websites.
That's all for this edition of How on Earth. This week's show was produced by yours truly, Joel Parker. Our theme music was written and produced by Josh Cutler. Additional music, Astronomy Domini by Pink Floyd. Visit our website at howonearthradio.org to find past episodes, extended interviews, and you can subscribe to our podcast through iTunes and follow us on Facebook and X. Do you have questions or comments? Call the KGNU comment line at 303-447-9911. For How on Earth, the KGNU Science Show, I'm Joel Parker.